Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, happy Easter, and you're very welcome to the show. And I'm sorry if it's a shock to some of you to hear my voice. It is 11 o'clock now, in case you missed all that ridiculous moving of the hour. So let's have a look at the Easter Sunday papers. The Sunday Times is leading with an extraordinary story about Christy Kinahan and his... He's a kind of a tour guide. He does a lot of reviewing on Google of everything from acai bowls to fishing trips and stuff like this. So they, together with Bellingcat, they've used it to track his movements around the place. The Sunday Times is leading with the Geoffrey Donaldson, or the Sunday Independent, I beg your pardon, is leading with the Geoffrey Donaldson story. The Business Post has Patrick Honohan, the former governor of the central bank, saying that expanding the central bank's powers risks a new financial crash. And that is something that it's been suggested by BlackRock and I think one other institution. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Virgin wants a slice of RTE's licence fee pie. Rival broadcaster writes to minister seeking 30 million share. The Sun... is back to the Kinahans, shakedown for Kinahan, and this is, they seem to be suggesting that Sheikh Al Maktoum, the leader of the UAE, is the crucial person who might aid us in bringing the Kinahans to justice, and that they think that there's a real prospect they can win him over on that. The Sunday World has two of the Hutches out shopping for a car, and the Mirror is leading with April Fuels Day, and that is the cost of living crisis set to deepen as fuel and services increase in price and a range of supports come to an end. Now, our panel this morning, who all got up at the crack of dawn reading papers for us: Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner; Louise Bayliss, founder of Spark, an advocacy group for single parents and campaign coordinator for Focus Ireland; Dan O'Brien is chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs; and Lorna Fitzpatrick is a public accounts manager at Instinctive Partners and a member of the Labour Party. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brendan.
How is everyone feeling? I have to say, it's an age thing, I think. You know, they say like that there's more of a chance of having a heart attack or you know, having an accident or something. For the first time this year, I have felt I could have a heart attack today. The hour is is tough, isn't it? Is everyone feeling bright and bushy-tailed? Yes.
I'm actually in kind of a, I don't sleep a lot, so I get up early every day, so it's no big difference.
I'm so excited about it, I didn't go to bed.
Yeah. Okay, so look, there's a lot going on. I suppose there's a general kind of conversation across the papers about politics, not just like what's going to happen over the next year, but I suppose a broader discussion about a refocusing of the political conversation, maybe. So maybe if we start with the election prospects and that picture. So early election likely despite Harris's plan to see out full term as a new Taoiseach. Mick, do you think there's going to be an election autumn or the new year?
Prior to Leo Varadkar resigning, there was a relatively general consensus that it would probably be in the autumn, there may be an earlier election, the government would hope for a feel-good factor and that they would go to the polls. The other element to that is the alternative would most likely be February if they were going to go to full term. They'd hardly go all the way to March. Winter election, the usual problems, hospital overcrowding, people feeling a bit cranky, etc. And also they lose whatever advantage they have in terms of surprise. So that was the way it was felt prior to Leo Varadkar resigning. Some people are reassessing it, that Simon Harris, incoming Taoiseach, would want to have a bit of a spell and he might want to go the whole way, and also that his government partners might put it to him, well, we're okay with you coming in, but now you've got to give us a commitment, we're going the whole way. That was a kind of speculation around the last couple of weeks, and now we're seeing it's pulling back towards quite possibly an autumn election today. I think it was in the Mail on Sunday. So, I mean, I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised if it was an autumn election. The problem for Simon Harris there, obviously, is it gives him very little time to put any kind of a stamp on his premiership.
Yeah. Lorna?
Yeah, I read the same piece in the Mail on Sunday there by John Lee and John Drennan. And I think what struck me about it was that, yes, I think there is that general sense that we're moving maybe towards that autumn election, or moving back towards that, should I say. But what struck me in the piece was the person close to Simon Harris who was commenting about why it would go the whole hog over to March was so that Simon Harris as Taoiseach would get to meet the US president and give the picture of stability while letting people at home think of the appalling vista of a Sinn Féin leader there, end quote. And really what struck out to me there was that...
No, this is all complete speculation.
Oh, absolutely.
Unnamed sources.
Unnamed sources, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And close to and all of that, you know, the usual pieces there. But what stood out to me was that, you know, there wasn't any reference to fixing the housing crisis or the crisis in health. There was nothing about trying to address the challenges that parents have when it comes to children with special educational needs trying to get school places. There was nothing about the challenges that disabled people are facing and the green paper around that that, you know, has been a significant controversy for disabled people. So it really felt to me as if it was about giving Simon Harris a moment in the sun in the US with the bowl of shamrock rather than
I
dealing
with
the issues.
I think you will find that they all fall under one of his pillars, which is security, and security covers all those matters and more. Dan, you were looking at that piece as well.
Yeah, Irish politics is more unpredictable than certainly any time in my life. So I think a lot of politicians are not sure themselves what they want to do and when the election will take place. The electorate has done a lot of things that people didn't expect in recent times. So I think it'll be more of an opportunistic kind of decision to go rather than any sort of strategic decision.
Do you think, is there a sense of a chaotic kind of uncertainty around politics in Ireland, do you think?
Oh, in society, I think there's a lot of stuff bubbling under the surface and coming up to the surface. I don't know what to make of it. You go back to recent elections, 2016, the view was Irish voters like stability. The Fine Gael Labour government got us out of the bailout, will be re-elected. Nonsense. Wasn't true. Even Sinn Féin didn't expect to do so well in the 2020 election. Out of the blue, really big change. Recent referendums, out of the blue, people, huge numbers voted against those referendums, which wasn't expected. A lot of stuff happening that, frankly, I don't understand. I don't think anyone does. There's a lot of stuff bubbling around there that, politicians are looking and saying, you know, what do voters want? What's going on here? And that makes things very unpredictable.
Yeah. Louise?
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot will be decided on June 9th when we have the local elections, and parties will be re-evaluating, because we know that Sinn Féin have put out an awful lot of candidates this time compared to previous elections, because obviously they didn't get the seats they should have gotten based on their vote from the last time. They hadn't fielded enough candidates, so they're putting out an awful lot of candidates this time. It'll really depend on I think, how the independents do in the local elections. Are there going to be emergence of far-right parties? We saw, Michael McDowell down in Wexford this weekend or last weekend, you know, drumming up all the independent votes. I think no political party can guarantee what's going to happen. While there is speculation about October and everything, I think it'll all hinge on the European elections and the local elections in June.
It's an interesting point, Mick, isn't it? That will be the first kind of lay of the land they're going to get on things.
It will. I mean, you know, beyond kind of speculating about numbers and who may get on and dates, I mean, Dan touched on it there, the whole issue of politics at the moment. And Gary Murphy has a quote, a well-known quote from a figure from the French Revolution, they're good people, I must follow them for I am their leader. And he's referencing Sinn Féin there in the way they flip-flopped and a lot of things. But equally, you could well suggest that the same applies to Fine Gael. I mean, this thing now, Simon Harris comes in, there's talk about a law and order, there's talk about moving to the right. There's no indication whether any of this is any innate political philosophy emanating from Simon Harris. It's just, let's look where things are at the moment and let's follow that. And equally with Sinn Féin, the most alarming thing last week, I thought, with Sinn Féin was in relation to the EU asylum pact, that they want Ireland to opt out of it. And they began their press release with, we are not in favour of open borders. Now, open borders is a term of the far right. There are no open borders in Western society. Why they keep repeating that now? And they seem to be following as well. And then we had these referendums and people are reading all sorts of things into those that they're suggesting the country is at a particular place. I wouldn't be half as sure at all. I'd say there could be myriad different reasons for those referendums the way
they are. We know there were, like, and everyone claimed their own reason was the reason. But actually the only thing, no, look, we'll take it for what it is, but there was an exit poll done for Ireland Things by the Sunday Independent, and I remember them pointing out at the time that the thing that kept floating up to the top was a lack of clarity, people.
Absolutely.
So, and as much as the so-called anti-woke people are saying, don't say we didn't know what we were voting for, people did know. Clearly a lot of people
The whole thing was down to the government thought this is a simple matter. This is something that should have been taken out of the Constitution. We've been talking about it 25 years. Just go ahead and do it. They put no effort into it. They put no clarity into it. That was at the heart of it. And as you say, people are reading all sorts of things out of it. Political parties are scratching around now to see what it means and try and follow that.
Lorna, are you part of this woke brigade and are you concerned now that there's a backlash against the increasing left-wingization of everything in this country?
Well, look, I think I have my values and my beliefs, and I don't think woke is the language that I would use. But I think, you know, at times like this, when you have those results from those referendums and so on, like, it's hard to fight for equality in the tough days. But it's the right thing to do, in my view, you know, and that's what I'll continue to do.
But do you feel like the tide is turning on the kind of things that you believe?
No, I don't. But what I do think is that there is serious miscommunications, misinformation and disinformation that is leading to a feeling across society where there is distrust or mistrust. And there was a piece actually by Alison O'Connor in the Sunday Times today, page 16. It was, it's pointless to appease anti-woke brigade that won't compromise. And one of the pieces, or one of the quotes from that she has in there is that, you know, these conversations, this anti-woke stuff is designed to make people paranoid, unhappy and disbelieving, to lose trust in institutions and believe anything communicated by them, by officialdom, is to be scoffed at and distrusted. And that really stood out to me because over the last couple of months in particular, I've been having conversations with my friend groups, my wider circle and so on, where they have a massive distrust in anything that's coming through from government. And I spend an awful lot of time kind of sitting down going, well, actually, no, what this in my view means is X, Y or Z, you know, whether it was about the referendum, whether it's about the hate speech legislation, whether it's about the late licensing laws, whatever the case may be. There was a feeling, and there is a feeling there that I see coming through, that people don't trust what they're being told. And part of it is that there's not enough clarity about what it is that they're about the topics that we're discussing. And so it leaves a space and uncertainty, you know, that lack of information creates the uncertainty that we're seeing across the board. So it's not that I think people are rolling back on their beliefs that everyone is entitled to a right to safety or, you know, the beliefs of values of fairness and equality or anything like that. I think a lot of it is stemming from that lack of information, which is breeding mistrust and disinformation.
Dan, are you part of the anti-woke brigade who thinks we should get back to the
absolutely
basics?
Absolutely, implacably hostile to illiberal left or right, and the illiberal left, aka woke, is not my cup of tea. But if I had a...
Is this actually a realistic recalibration by the powers that be of realising that actually we had been listening too much to NGOs and all these people, and that actually what the people want is something different?
I think there's a lot of truth in that, and my hunch is that immigration is the big issue here. A set of figures last week from Eurostat, the European Statistical Agency, that showed in 2022 alone, 250,000, the foreign population of Ireland rose by 250,000. At a time when there's a housing crisis, My hunch is, and I'm married to an immigrant and I spent most of my adult life as an immigrant in other countries, my hunch is that people feel it's gone too far, it's having negative effects, and for too long in this country, we have had this thing where we cannot say there's any negative or downsides from immigration. There is. There are. Okay? We need to be honest about that. Immigration has many positive effects. It has some negative effects. And when it gets to big, big numbers like 250,000 people, then it has big negative effects. So my hunch is that that surge in immigration is the main thing that's causing this unsettlement. Could be wrong about that. But
does anyone disagree with anything Dan is saying there?
How does it express itself, Dan, in this country? And I know it has in other European countries in different ways, particularly in the UK. But in terms of immigration, the only way it's expressed itself here has been opposition to asylum seekers and the problems there are with accommodating them during the housing crisis. And asylum seekers here represent something like 0.3% of the population. It's a tiny number in the state of 5 million. No, maybe I've missed it, but I have not detected, outside those who have what we call far-right views or whatever, that there is any resentment towards immigration in general when people go into our hospitals, when they go take a bus, when they the service industries and all, and they see that. It has only manifested itself in relation to that tiny issue around asylum seekers so far.
Okay, so the opinion polls are asking questions like, is there too much immigration? And large numbers of people are saying there is.
What do they understand by immigration?
Well, these are the sort of questions we need to ask. Yeah. And what I'm saying is that part of the conversation we have not had up to now is anyone who raised the issue of downsides of immigration was immediately shouted down as being a member of the far right. Yeah. That's stupid. Mm. It is stupid. Yeah. Migration is a complex social phenomenon with upsides and downsides. And the notion that 250,000 people coming in a single year is not going to exacerbate the housing crisis, which most of us agree is the number one issue, is just
hang
silly.
On, 250,000 people in a single year?
That is what Eurostat numbers came out with. They said that at the beginning of 2002, there were 900,000 foreign nationals, foreign non-Irish-born people living in Ireland. By the 1st of January 2023, that had increased by 250,000.
Sorry, you said 2022 to 2023.
In that year, from January 1st to 2022 to January 1st, 2023. They're estimates.
So that's including the 100,000 Ukrainians?
Ukrainian, a lot of it's people including, come here with work permits, yeah. People who come with study, people who come who are other refugees, the whole lot, all. So it's the foreign national population here. Now, those numbers are likely, these are expert statisticians, to be in the ballpark. So it is a very big number. And in my view, what has caused this change is largely people just saying, wow, this is a big change that suddenly happened.
Okay, Lorna or Louise, would you disagree? Have people not been allowed to have an honest, realistic conversation about immigration?
I think that is true. And I think when you suppress conversation, there is myths that come about. But I will say something. I was on the bus this morning coming here, and it was early morning getting on the bus. And by far, the majority of people on that bus were migrant workers going to work on a Sunday in jobs that Irish people don't want to do. So there are benefits. But I agreed with Dan to some extent that we do have to have a conversation about how we cope with 250,000 coming in. And of course, if we don't, we get misinformation, disinformation coming in. And we do have to shore up that vacuum. But also, you know, this idea of open borders is absolutely ridiculous. We have a duty, morally, an obligation and legal right to process people who are coming to our countries for international
protection.
But I suppose
people do have an issue, and they would be right around the fact that processing is not
happening.
Yeah,
and that's what I was going to say. We cannot close our borders. We have international and moral obligations to house refugees when they come here. How we do them probably does need to be, you know, checked, and the introduction of safe countries and processing people faster is much better for everybody, for migrants coming in, for refugees coming in, saying that their applications are processed quicker and that they have shelters when they get here, and the, you know, all of this goes into place. So yes, we have to have the conversations, but we have to have it in a way that's respecting the moral obligations we have to our...
Lorna, would you disagree with anything that Dan is saying?
Well, I think the issue here, and I think Louise hit it there, is that it's the systems that are failing. You know, it's the systems around housing, it's the systems around international protection, and they're the issues, and that's how we're seeing the conversations come up in relation to migration, and that migration is being seen as an issue. In reality, it's the system around housing and the system around international protection that are issues, and if they were dealt with, then there would be less of a concern, I think, across the population when it comes to migration.
Just one very quick thing. Yeah. I mean, Dan's point is well made, but the categories of people that make up immigration, apart from asylum seekers, which is tiny, are those that move within the EU, and there's free movement. There's absolutely nothing we can do about that. People come here because the economy is doing well, and work permits. If there, and there should be a conversation, but examine so, and work permits are huge numbers. Are they required? Do we need them? That sort of thing should be examined, absolutely. But it shouldn't all be thrown back on people who are fleeing war and oppression, because we have domestic issues here ourselves to deal.
And Dan, I think I remember you making that very point months back here, before anyone else was talking about it, that the vast majority of migration is stuff like work permits.
Absolutely. It's people like it, student visas. 2022 is different because of the Ukraine catastrophe. But in most migration takes place because people are either are people coming to work or study, and that's, you know, making a contribution. You could argue that people coming, as my wife did, to learn English here doesn't make much of a contribution. Would you say that you'd have less language students coming if we have such pressure on housing? I think you could perfectly make a policy position to say, look, there are too many language students coming because it's great for them and it's great for the language schools, but they have to live somewhere. And, you know, a whole bunch of language students crammed into a single apartment, it, you know, has difficulties, it adds to the pressure. So I just think we need to have a rational. Where are there policy areas? Where are the costs and the benefits of immigration? Can we reduce it in some areas where there are less benefits? But be open and not label everyone who raises the issue as some sort of fascistic nutcase.
Okay. Okay. There are a few other aspects to this whole conversation in the papers today. Mick, you picked a piece with Helen McEntee in the Sunday Times, There's So Much I Want to Do in Justice, and you also picked Harris's Law and Order plan in the Sunday Independent. So this is another aspect of this getting back to basics, law and order, real crime versus imaginary crime, as we've heard people talk
and
about.
And all of that, and the speculation, we were speculating earlier, is some are speculating anyway that Helen McEntee will be moved out of justice. There's a perception among some in Fine Gael that she has not been, or not projected herself as the hard law and order, as the party likes to project a particular image. But she's making the point, and she's making a very valid point today about the so-called hate speech bill, which again has, I think, been completely blown out of proportion. And Alison O'Connor touches on that as well in relation to the actual title of that bill. What we are calling hate speech is criminal justice, incitement to violence or hatred and hate offences. Most of it is about people getting on a bus and abusing the bus driver because of it, he doesn't come from the country or whatever, and that kind of hate crime. And that's getting sidelined over a tiny issue that I suspect...
Well, the definition of hate is not a tiny issue for a lot of people.
Well, by all accounts, how do you specifically define it? I mean, it would be obvious to most people the difference between somebody having an opinion about an issue or being critical of something and somebody saying something to incite hatred. I mean, and that's the kernel.
But did we not learn a lesson here with the referendums that, like, it's not good enough to say to people, look, it'll be fine, it'll be worked out in the courts. Like, people obviously aren't happy with that. They like to know, if I'm going to be prosecuted for hate, I want it to be defined in the law.
Brendan, they have hate crime legislation in most of Europe. They don't seem to have any problem defining what exactly hate is there. To my mind, it has suddenly become an issue here on the basis, on the very narrow basis of issues around gender, and particularly people who've problems with what they regard as NGOs running things. That's the kernel of the opposition that originated with this. They've no problem defining hate anywhere else. I don't see how it can be such a big issue here between somebody having an opinion on something and somebody saying something that's quite obviously designed to to incite people to have hatred against a particular category of person.
Okay, Lorna, there's another allied thing. You see, there's been this sense around the hate crime that would wave through at the time by all the TDs and everything, and that now suddenly, with this new kind of anti-woke lens on, they're all looking at it afresh and going, well, actually, is there something similar going on around this so-called Dancing Till Dawn bill? You picked a piece by Julianne Carr. Like, at the time, it was like, well, we need to be like other European cities and all this. And I don't think there wasn't a huge backlash to it at the time, that pubs would be allowed to stay open till 2:30 and clubs, if they want to, till 6 o'clock. A lot of them today saying they probably would only do that on occasion. But suddenly now, again, it's like people are looking at it with a new lens and going, well, hang on a minute here.
Yeah, and that's what I find really about both the and I won't get the full name as Mick had it there, but the legislation around hate crime, or whether we're talking about the late licensing laws here. Like, none of these issues, these massive issues all of a sudden that have came onto the fore of everyone's mind in Sinn Féin and in some of the government parties and representatives, none of these came through earlier on in the process around this, when there was consultations, when there was public consultations, when the hate speech legislation launched. I think it was back in 2017. There was Dublin Bus. There was lots of representatives from across communities, footballers and so on the stage when that conversation was being started. And there was no issues around it then. In the same way as with the Dancing Till Dawn bill, there was no significant issues raised at the time when that was being introduced. Now, all of a sudden, people are getting a little bit antsy around it and are starting to raise issues or raise concerns. I can say I probably won't be Dancing Till Dawn, regardless as to whether these were in or whether they weren't. But what I think is really interesting is that all this does would provide an opportunity. And as you said, Brendan, most of the people in the club owners in the papers today were saying that they wouldn't be open till 6 a.m. every day of the week. It would be an exception to the rule rather than the rule itself. But that would be contrary to what you might think was the situation if you were to listen to some of those Fine Gael reps over the last couple of days about this legislation.
There has also been people saying that the amount of crime does go up. There are these figures, I think, kind of disputed, but that the amount of crime goes up for each hour you keep things open. Road traffic deaths will go up.
Yeah, and it can't be done on its own. And I think that's the bigger piece, right? So we do need to look at policing. We need to look at public transport. We need to look at workers' rights when it comes to those who will be working in these nightclubs up until 6 o'clock in the morning on the odd occasion that would happen. So all of those things need to happen in the round together. But the reality is that there's fewer than 90 nightclubs in Ireland today. Now, that's in comparison to 522 in 2000. Now, I know it was Celtic Tiger times, but like, that's a significant drop. I know in my own hometown, there's one nightclub and there's no late bar on a Friday. There's none of that. So like, I'm 30 years of age. We like to be able to stay out past midnight on a Friday night, but that's not something that's available to us down home at the moment. So I honestly don't think that this is something that really should be causing as much concern as what it appears to be at the moment, because it is a minor, it is going to have a minor implication on a couple of nights when these nightclubs would stay open until 6 a.m. rather than every night of the week.
Yeah. What does anyone else think?
I was listening, and I think what seems to be happening is that there seems to be a panic now that, oh, the legislation, we have to check everything because the government were trying to rush through. And if a politician decided this legislation was necessary, and I'm not saying things don't need to be amended and changes need to be made and, you know, opposition parties have a right to give proper amendments, but also politicians should have that moral backbone to say, this is what I believe, this is why, yes, I listen to you, I'll continue. And it struck me, and again, anybody who knows me would know I'm not a Fianna Fáil party member, supporter or anything like that, but this is the 20th anniversary this week of the smoking ban. Yeah. And I remember at the time thinking, really admiring Micheál Martin for having the moral courage to stand up to his beliefs despite all the, you know, people will vote against this, this is going to cause you a political thing. And I thought it was such a strong thing to do, and I'd like to see moral courage with politicians today to say, if this bill I believe, or this referendum I believe, I'll listen to you, I'll make the changes, I'll make the referendum, but I'll get it through the line and I'll explain to people why we need to get it over the line.
Mick, briefly, there's one more culture war we'll touch on, which is the flag. You picked Gary Murphy and Matt Cooper, both writing about the use and abuse of the tricolour.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it twice during the week. Now, there was the instance, Pearse McAuley, who was a man who was responsible for the murder of Garda Jerry McCabe, and subsequently was put in prison again for a vicious assault on his wife, Pauline Tully, who's now a Sinn Féin TD. There was very big controversy over the fact that the tricolour was used during his funeral. Also here last week, Rose Dugdale, an English aristocrat who decided she had to come over here and join what she thought was some sort of a revolution. She was buried with the tricolour. The tricolour was draped in her coffin. I don't think she was buried.
Taken off before she
was taken off. It was taken, and it was interesting the way it was taken off was the way the Irish army do it in terms of the military and what have you. And I mean, I certainly would be uneasy about the whole thing. I don't believe the tricolour should be used like that at all. And then Matt Cooper is coming at it from another angle. That's the way the tricolour is used by the so-called far right now at the moment. And that, you know, between it all, the flag is being very devalued, I think.
So the new Taoiseach was onto something with his take back our flag.
He was a bit, possibly, you know.
And Jesus, very, very grudgingly. you've just kind of made his argument for him.
The way he did it, Brendan.
You're embarrassed now about being caught on the same side as a politician on anything.
Say that the way he did it, I just thought it was a too bit drama involved in the way he did it. But I mean, there's no doubt it is being used by and has been for a long time. Yeah.
We all know 1990. Sinn Féin TDs agreed about the use of the tricolour last week, certainly for Pearse McAuley.
Oh yeah, definitely. But like, we all remember Jack Charlton 1990. One of the things people were often saying was he reclaimed the tricolour because people were afraid of it at the time of when Ireland was an Italian 90 and that sort of thing. And
yeah,
there's elements of that again at the moment, particularly with the far right.
So we need the football team to,
we do, yeah,
to step up and get a manager and reclaim the flag. Dan, just before we go to the break, so look, the Geoffrey Donaldson story, and Geoffrey Donaldson has resigned after being accused of historic sexual crimes. He will strenuously deny it all. Let's put that aside. And in terms of the effects it could have, so first people saying this is an earthquake, then very quickly it seemed that the politicians from all sides, Emma Little, Pengelly, and Michelle O'Neill, coming in to say this is not going to derail things and we will be hoping to continue on with stability. You picked Newton Emerson in the Sunday Times, who is questioning that kind of nothing to see here narrative.
Yeah, well, the DUP is a deeply divided party. Geoffrey Donaldson was the leader of that party and was the main person bringing his party back into Stormont. There are many elements within the DUP who oppose that. There are other parts of the unionist community, notably the TUV, who is deeply opposed to that. So I think to say there are no risks that there is a further collapse would be wrong. It will very much depend on what happens within the internal party workings of the DUP and whether somebody challenges the interim leader, Gavin Robinson. So I would be very concerned that we're going to have a further period of instability. And if we do have that, real questions are going to be raised about the durability of the Good Friday Agreement and the institutions that were created around it, because they have spent an awful long time over the past 25 years in abeyance. And if it happens again, and it certainly could, it's a risk, I think further questions are going to be raised about the political institutions in Northern Ireland.
OK, let's take a break. Mick Clifford, Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien and Lorna Fitzpatrick staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Click and collect at over 100 Allcare pharmacies at allcarepharmacy.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Mick Clifford, Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien and Lorna Fitzpatrick are still with us. Lorna, the story of Martin Abbott in University Hospital Limerick has been told during the week, but there is an interview with his daughter Anne Marie by Maeve Sheehan in the Sunday Independent today. And I think, you know, people can half take things in during the week and everything, but when you sit with this and take a breath and read this story properly, it's absolutely appalling, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very sad. And I suppose just to start off with, you know, acknowledging the hurt and the pain that that Martin's family are going through with this being in the papers and so on again. And at this time with the review taking place, I suppose just to bring people through the story a little bit. Martin Abbott attended the emergency department in UHL in 2019 in December. He was later diagnosed with Legionnaire's disease and was already immunosuppressed from a kidney transplant, so he was already at a greater risk of infection and so on. He spent 3 days in hospital on a trolley and his condition deteriorated. But the report that is the feature of the piece today indicated that the deterioration was not detected. So in the 24 hours before he had died, Martin's vital signs should have been recorded every 30 minutes. But the report stated that due to overcrowding, and I suppose it was so severe, that there were gaps in recording of his vital signs ranging from 40 minutes to 10 hours and 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. There were 25 incorrect entries of early warning on the early warning charts, and his early warning score had been miscalculated on 9 separate occasions. The report stated about nurses feeling rushed and under pressure, and that their workload was excessive, and that staff resources were inadequate. And I suppose despite the serious amount of oversights and issues resulting from that, there was a 115-page review, and the single and overarching finding there was that severe overcrowding in the emergency department was the fundamental cause. Yeah,
these people were absolutely swamped. And look, a lot of us have been that soldier. It make a few things that stood out to me again reading it again this morning. This was not. It shouldn't matter, but this was not an old man. This man was 65. He'd been away for the weekend a few days before that. There'd been a party in the house as well. I think it was his daughter's 30th. You know, he was in the prime of his life and living his life and everything. Secondly, that his daughter was afraid to leave him. And I know people all over the country know that story, where Absolutely. They're sitting vigil with parents or whoever in an A&E because they are afraid to leave them because they have no faith that there's anyone keeping an eye on them at all. And they're trying to make bargains with people working in there to say, look, if I go out and have something to eat for an hour, get a bit of fresh air, will you make sure? And they're assuring people they will, but they can't assure people either a lot of the time because they're so snowed on.
Any of us who've been in there, we've experienced it to a greater or lesser extent, and thankfully not to the kind of extent that the Abbotts have here. But I mean, there's a particular problem for some reason with Limerick University Hospital, and there definitely is there. But overall, there are huge advances have been made in the health service, but in one area that this continually rises up again is admitting to the system through A&E. Now, from my amateur viewpoint, a huge amount of that surely has to do with the amount of beds that are in the system. But this occurs year after year. And okay, some people are suggesting that it's not as bad now as it was a few years ago, but it's still horrendous that things like this can still happen. And it's very difficult to understand why that element of things can't be addressed. And if it is simply down to beds, why we can't have a system whereby there are enough beds to care for people coming in through the A&E.
Can I just say something? I agree with all you've said, absolutely. Who could argue? But I do think there's a problem that's really come up in the last 5 years or so, where we have no access to primary healthcare, you know, to try to get a GP. Yes.
All these people who shouldn't be in
A&E.
Yeah,
exactly.
And they're being directed there a lot of the time.
They're being directed there because I very rarely get sick. And last year I got sick and was trying to phone up for a GP appointment. Now, God love the poor GP. She's probably never even heard my name, but trying to get an appointment was nearly 6 days waiting. And in that time, I knew I needed steroids and I knew I needed an antibiotic, but I couldn't get to them. I was very close to presenting to A&E, and only the guilt of I'm not sick enough for A&E, but also knowing I needed to get these tablets. And I think the A&E wards are being flooded by people who could be stopped. stopped at a much earlier stage.
Now, they do seem to be trialling putting a GP as a
and
gatekeeper.
And I think that is an amazing innovation. But I also think there's other things we could do. Like in the situation where I used to have recurring throats or whatever and knew I needed an antibiotic, where you have qualified pharmacists yes. that would be able to give a prescription and get you out of there. Yeah. It's we're not adapting at early prevention stages, and we're allowing people to go to hospital when they're sick. We wouldn't need as much A&E support if we got that at the primary care level.
I think the other thing that is a no-brainer is that we probably need more geriatricians anyway, but I guess there's not huge money in it. But geriatric clinics yeah. in every community that are keeping yeah. an eye on, because like if you go into an A&E, the reality is a lot of it is old people who probably shouldn't be there, have infections, they're delirious, they're frightened, they're angry, they're trying to get out of there. And that is what makes it, a lot of the time, the chaos it is. Dan?
Just this conversation, absolutely, totally valid conversation, but I think often when we talk about healthcare in Ireland, you get the impression we're some sort of developing country, okay? Mm-hmm. We have pretty good health outcomes overall here. I know I've been, with my own infant daughter, been in the system quite a bit recently. I cannot say enough about the staff, the nurses, the doctors in Crumlin Hospital, and what they've done and how well they do it. So I just
and I think once you get into the system, everyone yeah. agrees yeah, that it tends to be those entry points can be an issue.
It can be, and you know that's. But I just too often in Ireland we talk about our healthcare system as though the people in it, you know, they do fantastic work. It is by any international standard, our outcomes are not perfect. We spend a lot on our healthcare system, but our outcomes are sort of mid-range for most things. So I always think it's important not to catastrophize about our healthcare system, which is pretty good.
Okay, Lorna.
Yeah, and look, I don't have the stats, so I can't argue on a technical point on that. But I suppose, I agree with you and acknowledge what you're saying there around our outcomes. But at the end of the day, it's really hard for those families and for those staff and for the patients and so on to try and live with the fact that and accept the fact that we're not doing too bad, you know, in the grand scheme of things. I think, you know, the reality is, We do need real leadership when it comes to our health service. Someone who really just takes the bull by the horns, and if someone presents an issue as to why we can't have more beds, well, figure out a reason to get around it or a way to get around it. A recruitment freeze at the moment, does that seem like it's the most appropriate approach to trying to address the crisis that people face? I can't see that. I can't agree with that. So, you know, I do think there are measures in leadership that's required that we're just not seeing at the moment.
Okay, and the other issue that is on people's minds at the moment is road deaths, and it's been another very tragic week. Dan, there's an editorial in the Sunday Times: traffic deaths are rising and we must make our country safer. And they are indeed up substantially in the first quarter of this year compared to where they were last year.
There's been some increase and the numbers move around. Just a few facts. In the 1970s, 600 people were dying on our roads, okay? That has been absolutely slashed.
With a population of 3 million at that time, about.
And far fewer cars. So there has been, road safety has been one of the great success stories over the decades, okay? More people are dying of COVID at the moment, which we memory hold completely, than dying on the roads. We're not talking about that at all, but more people are dying of COVID than are dying on the roads, okay? Ireland has some of the safest roads in the world, not just in Europe, but in the world. Road traffic fatalities per million people are some of the lowest in the world. Now, that does not mean that every single tragic death is not something that is appalling for the families concerned. But I think we need to put things into perspective. Maybe coming back to the previous point, there is a tendency to catastrophize everything these days. Okay, we have done extremely well over the decades in bringing road deaths and injuries down, and that should be celebrated rather than saying we've a little bit of an increase, we need to legislate and do more stuff.
Yeah, it percentage wise it is substantially up, I think, on last year. Like it's in the mid-20s
reasons move around a bit, but okay. The same number of people are dying last year as 10 years ago, with a population of 500,000 yeah. more. So, you know, I just, those facts need to be put into conversation before okay. we just
yeah.
get panicked by an increase, and there's this, we have to do something, that new legislation every time. Maybe it's appropriate, but I'm simply saying that compared over the decades, it has been a huge success.
Yeah. Louise, but the point Dan makes, and maybe this is why it does kind of rise to the top of the agenda, is that each one of them is such a terrible tragedy on family and community. A sudden death out of the blue like that is possibly the worst thing that can happen.
It absolutely is. And I can remember vividly the 25th of July. My granddad was 56. He was driving home from the fish markets in wherever the fish markets were in town, back out to Howth.
That's how long ago was this?
Well, I was 10, so
okay, yeah.
So a long time ago, and he was driving home, and he was on the Clontarf Road. A van overtook another car. He swerved to avoid it. He went into a wall, and he was killed outright. My uncle, who was maybe 4 or 5 years older than me, was in the car with him, and my other uncle was in the back of the car. And I remember as a 10-year-old going up to Temple Street Hospital to see my uncle, who was 15 probably at the time, and going into Temple Street Hospital as a 10-year-old, and Mark was lying in the bed, and he was very upset. Obviously, he was injured, and he kept saying, "I kept trying to shake Daddy up, but Daddy wouldn't wake up. Where's Daddy? Why hasn't he come to me?" And as a 10-year-old standing in the hospital watching this, knowing that I knew his dad was dead, my granddad, and looking at my uncle, who I held up to esteem, you know, he's 5 years older than me, and watching him crumpled and holding that in was awful. And to be honest, I didn't even, obviously it was like a bomb going off in our family. Our family has never fully recovered.
Really?
I don't think our family has. You know, there's all of this, those who were in the car, those who weren't, the images, you know, I can remember my mom hysterical. My granny was 55, never married again. You know, all of that, had to move home. All of the different things that went on at that time still hold something to me. And when my son started driving, that's when the real trauma came up to me. I could not sit, and I couldn't figure it out. Like, I could not figure out what was going on with me. But every time he got into the car, I was like a bag of nerves. And I'd want to phone him to check, did he get somewhere safe? But I couldn't phone him in case he was still driving and I distracted him. I would sit there, like, literally shaking in fear. And then when he, you know, after about 6 months of driving, I started relaxing, going, okay, he can do this. And then it went into the winter and I went, oh my God, now the frost is on the streets. And I went through it again for another whatever a month. And I still cannot get over that. And that was the first time that trauma showed me, because I didn't mind when I drove myself because I was in control. But that fear when my son went out that I was going to get a similar knock that we got all those years ago.
There's
a few basic things that can be done. We don't need legislation. Right? First of all, the number of Gardaí policing the roads has decreased. That's something that can be addressed, hopefully, relatively easily. Secondly, there was a huge success in the 80s when Gay Byrne was overseeing the Road Safety Authority, and there was a massive advertising campaign, and there was a lot of investigative journalism, I think it was an RTE from recollection at the time. That had a huge impact. Adopting that for the current generation, for the type of media consumed by younger people, and, you know, there's a lot of issues around younger people late at night still and all that sort of thing. Those are relatively small things that can be done, that can, you know, the statistics would suggest it can basically save lives, and we can do it. We don't have to, I mean, fair stands correct, we don't have to catastrophise, but we can do those small
things. Put a bit of TikTok maybe,
exactly.
Actually. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And not just the calm side of it is absolutely accurate. I fully agree and support. But I also think, like, you know, there was an issue down home recently. There's a really bad bridge. There's a bridge with a really bad bend on it, and there was a man injured. He was cycling recently, and he was hit by a vehicle, and he was badly injured. And groups down home had been asking for speed ramps to be put in to try and slow cars on sent to this bridge, and this bad bend. And we were told we can't have speed ramps because cars hit them too fast a speed, and it causes damage to the car, which leads to insurance claims against the local authority. So, you know, there's a common sense element government here as well when it comes to measures like speed ramps to help slow people down.
Okay. Yeah, and I was just thinking what you said, Mick, about, you know, TikTok and communications is absolutely really true. But I also think it's important that people who have a lived experience of losing somebody in a car crash gets their story out there and absolutely. People actually hear the impact. Because you hear numbers and it doesn't make an impact. But when you hear an actual story of, like, there was an article yesterday about a woman talking about her young child, her young man, son being killed 20 years ago with drugs. Somebody else had drugs in their system.
Cocaine and alcohol.
So when you hear these stories, I think it makes an impact.
Okay. Mick Clifford, Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien and Lorna Fitzpatrick staying with us. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Mick Clifford, Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien and Lorna Fitzpatrick are still with us. Mick, you were looking at that extraordinary story in the Sunday Times about Christy Kinahan Sr.
Yeah, Christy Kinahan Sr. It's an investigation, Sunday Times and Bellingcat, an investigative journalistic outlet. They basically tracked Christy Kinahan, his reviews. He did an awful lot of Google reviews under, I think the name was Chris Vincent. And it was right throughout Africa, Asia and Europe. And he'd be reviewing hotels and restaurants and the likes. And even stuff. And one theme that comes across is he's always looking for good value for money in various places. And other stuff like suggesting particular eateries were good for families with children. Now, as I understand it, he's in a second marriage. He has young children himself. He's a man in his 60s, I think, at this stage. And, you know, he's talking stuff like in one place he walked out when there was a long wait, which is okay for adults, but not for children. And another place, a waitress was calling him boss and he didn't like this. And it's surreal in one way.
Yeah, there's no suggestion as to why he's doing it, is there?
No, and you get the impression that it's for nothing more than ego or basically something to keep himself occupied. I certainly, there's no impression that he's doing it for any strategic thing to do with his crime empire or anything like that. But it's very odd. I mean, I wrote a book with a prison officer who knew Christy Kinahan when he was in Port Leash in the early 90s. But he described him as very different from all the other inmates there, in that if there's ever any violence, he never got involved. He'd walk back into his cell. He was always looking for books. If he couldn't get one, he'd give an explanation.
He kind of educated himself in prison, didn't he?
Very much so. And somebody who, and this is a huge thing with an awful lot of people, particularly low level of crime, they have no emotional intelligence. He had huge emotional intelligence and all that. So he's quite obviously has all of that. But it is very odd that somebody, particularly who realises that he's so wanted in so many jurisdictions, including the USA, that he got involved in this kind of thing.
Absolutely bizarre. Dan, I'd like to get a bit of an overview from you when you're here before we finish up. Where are we at with the economy? America defying all the rules and stock markets roaring and all of that. Are we going to see some interest rate decreases there and here and stuff?
Yeah, I think people who are paying mortgages can look forward to a number of cuts this year. Inflation is coming down nicely, coming back to normal. Jobs are growing on trees. We haven't had a hard landing because of this increase in interest rates designed to crush inflation.
Have they crushed inflation without crushing economies?
This was a big fear that was going to happen. Europe has had a more difficult time than the United States, but we've had bigger hits. The Ukraine war has had a bigger hit on us than the United States. But we have very low unemployment in most countries in Europe. It is astounding how resilient the European economy has been, and the US economy, and the Irish economy, with COVID and interest rates and wars and all these conflicts, and we still have incredibly low unemployment. Now, that's not to say that there are risks out there. You know, there's a risk of the Ukrainian war expanding, unfortunately, into the rest of Europe. That is now a real risk. Donald Trump comes back and he slaps import tariffs on all Irish goods. That could really damage the economy. There's always risks out there. But right now, compared to, say, 3 or 4 months ago when things were looking a lot more wobbly, it's actually surprisingly good.
And I know we've kind of slid in and out of technical recession at times, but in terms of a real recession, as you always point out, unemployment being the big important thing there, what percentage chances are you putting that at?
Of
there being some kind of a real recession or some kind of adverse?
I think it would take a big shock.
Yeah.
out of sort of, you know, nuclearization of the Ukraine war, major transatlantic trade war, for something to do that. At the moment, the indicators are looking pretty solid. I don't see domestic risks bringing the economy into recession. If anything, the economy is growing too fast, which is causing the sort of problems we're having in housing, et cetera, et cetera. So many of the economic problems we have now are actually because the economy is too strong. That is, again, always caveat.
Things, you're making me nervous. I'd say you're making yourself nervous talking like that.
Things can always come out of left field. Yeah. But at the moment, looking at that dashboard of economic indicators, it's a pretty pleasing picture.
Okay.
At the moment.
Were 3 or 4 interest rate reductions this year, would you think?
Certainly at least 2. It could be.
And they'd be 50 points rather than 25.
I think they'll start with 25. So okay. I think by the end of the year, you could be looking at a full basis point, a full what percentage?
1%.
Point.
Okay. Lorna, you were traumatized by the front of the Business Post.
Well, I thought really we need some flashing amber lights or some red flags for my generation. The front of the Business Post was a story by Kathleen Gallagher about expanding central banks' powers risks a new financial crash, and that was a quote from a former governor of the central bank. And I suppose it really just jumped out to me because I thought, can we not learn the lessons from the past? It was on the basis that, you know, some fund managers and so on had indicated to the minister that it would be beneficial for the central bank to take on a role in relation to supporting growth and innovation. And to me, I don't know, I'm far from an expert in this space, but it would seem to me that if the former governor of the central bank is saying, I don't know whether to laugh or cry at this suggestion, and that we really shouldn't be putting growth and innovation as a role on the regulator, then let's listen to that and go with that line, would be my thought on it.
Okay. Mick, will we finish up on Louis Walsh?
Ah, yeah. I love this. Louis Walsh, my terror at being paid €1 million to go into the Big Brother household. And it's a nice interview.
Niamh Horan has an interview in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah, it's a nice interview, but he spoke about being an insomniac and how he had great difficulty. I didn't realise until someone told me in here that he got to the final. But so he did very well for
guilty
himself.
Guilty as charged for watching.
Yeah. But yeah, and I love the way he ends. He's asked, would he write a book? And he said, no, that everyone would be running for the airport if he did.
Did you watch it all, Lorna?
I did, yeah. I wouldn't have been a Big Brother fan at all, but my partner loved it back in the day. And then when it came back, I think it's only back. I'm honestly not that much of an expert. But we did. We did watch it.
I knew he was coming across very badly.
Yeah, he loves the drama.
Has he kind of saved himself now?
He loves the drama. He was in there for the absolute drama, really. But he didn't do himself any favours with Jedward or with Ronan Keaton, I don't think, based on some of his comments in there.
Okay, I'd say he's not too worried about
it. I don't think that was his concern,
stage,
no.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much to my panel this morning. Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner, Louise Bayliss, founder of Spark and campaign coordinator for Focus Ireland, Dan O'Brien, chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs, and Lorna Fitzpatrick, public affairs accounts manager at Instinctive Partners and a member of the Labour Party.